You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Westwave Audio, LA's new API dealer. And now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez. And before we get going, I want to introduce the guys that are here. To my right, I've got Martin Page.
How you doing?
Scott Gershon.
Hello.
Bobby Summerfield.
Hello.
And Rob Arbertier.
Good evening, Mike.
Today on the Audio Nowcast, we are privileged to have Larry Dropa, president of API, to sit in our sixth seat. Larry, why don't you say hello?
Hello.
Larry Dropa and I have a history. We both – actually, Rob, you too. We've all worked with Stevie Wonder, along with the fact that Larry and I in Korea ate silkworm larva.
That created a bond, didn't it?
That's right.
Did you guys realize there was a McDonald's next door?
No,
it was McDonald's.
Yeah. You get two guys in a foreign country late at night shopping at the midnight mall. It was a mall that didn't open until midnight. And let me tell you, you see all the different foods and snacks that they have here, and all you got to say is, I dare you. And come on.
Exactly. I dare you, you dare me. Okay, I'll do one if you do one.
So it tastes like chicken or what?
You know what? Larry had it first, and he actually chewed the silkworm larva, and the look on his face was just...
Stop you eating the next one.
No, I got it in my mouth and down to my stomach as fast as I could.
I learned an early on a Korean word, room service.
That escaped us somehow.
Yeah, that's
– Hey, I will say, though, it was – you know, the shopping, if you – Korea has the best shopping probably of any place that I've ever been to. It's just – it was amazing. The same mall during the day was a regular retail mall for people, and then in the evening it became a bunch of little restaurants, and then – the midnight mall was like wholesale. It was just wholesale and insects, you know.
Sounds delicious.
But Larry, why don't you tell us a little bit about your work with Stevie? Because I think you had probably one of the best road gigs you can find. Larry actually mixed monitors for Stevie, and it was just for Stevie himself. And when you really think about it, he was the eyes of Stevie. You were in charge of the visual picture. Why don't you talk a little bit about your experience with Stevie?
Well, you're right, Mike, and I think it really was a tremendous opportunity to be able to do a job like that. What I did was had a console that took all the microphones from the stage. At times we were up to 72 inputs at various points in time.
Thanks to me.
Thanks to Rob and multitudes of keyboards. Mixed them together to stereo and then sent that stereo mix to an RF transmitter. Stevie wore an RF receiver under his jacket, which then earpieces plugged into his ears. And so what the mix that I sent him was the mix that he heard on stage. The earpieces that plugged in his ears canceled out a lot of the outside world so that the stereo image that he was able to hear presented the field that he heard on the stage so that the backup singers, for example, were in the same place in his head every night. So he knew who was singing by where they were in stereo, left to right. There were two other keyboard players on stage, and their position in his head was in the same place every night. So he knew who was playing. If somebody made a mistake, he knew who it was. He could call him out. And then we also, by closing out the outside world, I needed to feed stereo microphones into that system also so Stevie could hear the audience reaction. So between songs, anytime he wanted audience reaction or participation, I would bring those mics up into his mix. And oftentimes, I think it provided a great feel for what the audience was like and what the band was like. But it also provided for me a way to check with Stevie to see if everything was okay, because he's the only one that could hear me. So I could get on the mic and end of the second song or so every night, I just... between songs, we'd go, is everything okay? And he'd just go, yeah. And it would be sort of shouting to the crowd, but he's really shouting to me saying, yeah, everything's okay.
That's the thing that the audience never realized. Larry used to feed a mic that I had into Stevie's monitors also, because I would be running all the computers and switching stuff and a lot of technology on the side of the stage. And we could talk to Stevie, and he would say things under his breath at just the most perfect time when no one would notice, but he would often be answering a question from Larry or me. And it's funny now. I can still look back at video from those concerts and realize that someone had asked him a question and he was answering it as the crowd thought he was reacting to them, but he wasn't.
No, that was one of the really cool things when I got on the gig, to see the interaction between Steve and Larry and Rob. And it was just the most subtlest little things, like monitor level. I remember you would ask him a question, because I would also have the feed, because I was a keyboard tech at that time. So if anybody had to go on stage to do anything or run and check something, I was kind of the gopher at that time. But it was really great to see how Larry would ask him a question and almost like shaking off pitches. Actually, Rob, you would feed him the set list, and if he wanted to do a song, you know, you'd start it.
Oh, it was like the pitcher and the catcher.
Exactly.
Like I'd say, okay, are we doing Isn't She Lovely? And then he'd shake his head no. And I'd say, okay, are we doing whatever, If It's Magic? And, you know, he'd give me the yes signal. But I'll tell you this, it got even more terrifying than that. In the early days of touring with him, this is in the mid-80s, we were using the earliest sequencers, and the first sequencer we used is actually one that I wrote for him, but then we ended up using Texture, which was a sequencer that Roger Powell had customized for us, and it was a very fast responsive system, and Stevie got comfortable with the idea that he could edit songs during the concert. So he would say things like, I mean, while we're doing the song, he'd say things like, skip the bridge, or let's, you know, give me an extra chorus, or the tag's not long enough, we need to do a few extra choruses. And I would actually sit there and like stop and start the sequencer, because it was very responsive. And I would actually jump to different sections of the song and have to edit sequences on the fly during the concert.
Wow.
And it was terrifying.
And the live drummer's playing to that, right?
Yeah, well, the band could hear him too. You know, if he said, you know, keep it going, or another chorus, or something like that.
I think James Brown used to do that, didn't he? Give me one more time.
Yeah, exactly. It was terrifying, though, and every now and then I'd have to just get on and say, can't do it. And there were a few times when we also had a live orchestra on stage, and he would try to pull those things, and I would just get on the mic and say, you know, the orchestra can't turn on a dime like that. You know, they got written music.
The charts can't be stretched like that.
Yeah, charts can't be stretched.
Well, I like the fact when you would give him stage directions, you know, like little to the left, and you could position him so he's looking out at the
crowd. Well, we got down to like a verbal shorthand where, as he would walk around the stage, he would look like he was comfortably walking around and he knew where the edge of the stage was. And he liked to make the audience think that he didn't know where he was. And actually, I'll tell this story too. There was one series of tours we did where we had a stage in the round that was shaped like a relief map of Africa. And it was sort of on an angle, so the bottom of the continent was maybe a foot or two above ground level, but then it went up maybe three or four more feet. So if you would walk to the top of the stage, there would then be a cliff to kind of go down into the ocean, and it was a drop of maybe 3 feet or 4 feet. I'm not sure exactly what it was. But there came to be a time in the show where he used to like to walk up to that edge, and the audience didn't realize he knew where he was.
Don't go.
If you were listening to our broadcast, which anybody in the audience who brought an FM receiver, they didn't know this at the time, but if they brought a receiver, they could listen. We were just using regular FM frequencies. But you could hear me saying 3 feet, 2 feet. Okay, you got about 6 inches, 5, 4, 3, 2. And he would get to the point where he'd be standing.
Good job, you're a good guy.
Well, I was watching him very closely. And he would get to the point where his toes were hanging over the edge of this little cliff. And then right at the most exciting part of the song, he would throw his arms in the air and jump. Because he knew exactly where he was, and he would jump, and the crowd would just go crazy. Because for the whole first half of the song, they thought, oh no, he doesn't know what's going on. And then at that moment when he would jump, everybody realized the joke was on them, and he knew exactly where he was.
That's amazing.
He still loves to do stuff like that.
Yeah, Larry, so I always thought you had the best seat and the best job in all of touring.
I sure did, yeah.
So thank you for joining us today, and we're going to move on and talk about a couple issues of some things that are happening in the news. NAB starts this week, and I don't know if any of you guys are going to go to NAB. It's,
I haven't even heard of NAB. What's that?
NAB is
National Association of No.
Well, pretty much.
Yeah. Okay.
It's the broadcast show. It's similar to NAM, except on a much bigger level, and it has to deal with the broadcast industry. But a couple things that I want to talk about that rumors have it that they're going to be, you know, Apple's going to be releasing Final Cut Studio 6. And where that affects us is apparently in Final Cut Studio 6 with Soundtrack Pro, you'll be able to work in 5.1 on your computer. And as an audio engineer, that really scares me because I've had to deal with a lot of people that have done stereo mixes that they've come to the post-production place where I mix at and I have to fix it. And now to have editors out there mixing 5.1 on their laptop, that's definitely going to be a challenge to have to.
But you know, the market, the people don't know the difference.
Oh, I mean, I know.
It's crap. I mean, yeah, I agree. I appreciate your worry. And, you know, musicians have had that worry for many years. But the people that are buying cheeseburgers don't give a shit. If you have a great meal, they're like, yeah, whatever. It's great.
You know, I think.
And the people.
Go ahead.
No, sorry. I mean, but the dollars being the, you know, money being the bottom denominator of all evil in this respect. It's like, man, if this guy's doing a great artsy job, it's artsy, yeah, but it's all out of time, it's out of phase, and it's all shit in the center sections, yeah, in the back. But it's cool, like how cool. You'll see that all the good engineers will mostly be forced to mix the center channel in the surrounds in 4 years' time because it'd be a hip thing. So, you know, it's unfortunate, it's true. The herd is in control, and we are just such the minority. You've got to just face that.
Yeah, I know. But I can't tell you how often I get a project that comes to me where it's, you know, they've worked on their Final Cut system, and now they're going to polish it, and they want me to fix it.
Polishing a Richard, this is cool.
and you know what? I'm not knocking all editors because there's some really talented editors that they've done mixes where I've just been like, wow, that's amazing. You know, it's all done in the box and it comes to me and it's like, wow, that's really great. But can you imagine 5.1? Phase is one thing. Right off the bat, you're like, oh my goodness. And then the different levels, and they don't realize how the speakers all interact and why the center channel sounds the way it does as opposed to the surrounds and things like that. I mean, Scott, what do you think?
But you could take it another further. Why forget the picture cutter? Now the director can work on at his house, cut it. But I think what's actually going to stop all of it in reality, everyone's had the power for a long time. I mean, even with Avid, people with the money, nobody's got the time. Either time to master the craft or time to get the project done. And what I find is that with all the visual effects and all the possibilities now that are becoming available visually, there's so much more to do now than they've ever done. Who's got time for audio? Well, us audio guys do. And I think that it's a time issue. I think there's just not enough time in the day from the beginning of a project to when it needs to be released to have one person theoretically do it all.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Which brings me to another point with just 5.1 audio. 5.1 is an audio-only format. It's failed miserably. And why do you guys think it's
in music?
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about, in music, Super Audio CD and things like that.
Like the old what was the guy who said, who would want to buy two speakers when you got one? I mean, it's like, why would – people got stereo speakers. It sounds great. Why have five – people don't want to spend the money.
I don't think it's
– And headphones come in stereo.
I don't think it's dead forever. I think eventually it'll become the norm that people have – home theaters, the way now everybody has a television set. At some point, it's going to become the norm that people are going to have more than two speakers. When companies can come out with great wireless surround speaker systems so that it's not a big installation, then wives are going to be a lot more willing to let insane husbands, put in a bunch of technology because you don't have a bunch of unsightly wires around. I think over time, 5.1 is still going to be more prevalent and, it'll mostly be starting for home theaters, but if you already have a home theater and you see a disc on a shelf or see a download that you can download that's 5.1, if you're already set up for it, I think it will be something you'd want to listen to.
Do you guys like 5.1 music? Do you listen to stereo band?
Some of it, right.
Exactly.
I find some of it is mixed in a way that gives a pleasing experience, and some of it sounds like they were just playing with joysticks and it's very uncomfortable.
It kind of reminds you of synthesizers with LFOs and filters. Everyone did those, oh, wow, look, there's a synth. I can do this really cool. Yeah, this sounds. And I think what happens is, I mean, I've been doing 5.1 for over 20 years. And I think that's just no big deal in my life. But when I start seeing music people do it, they go, hey, let's start doing tricks. Oh. And really what it comes down to is content, how we capture it and all of that. It's all about what you're actually capturing and not the shtick. Mm-hmm. And like in the quote unquote 5-1, you want to be able to give people an experience and using that technology to enhance that experience, but not to use it as kind of schlocky, you know, stuff.
Well, yeah, I remember hearing a story about some famous 70s album that they went in to remaster and they put the vocals down the center channel and they
That was Spinal Tap, I think.
No, but they didn't realize that you can, you know, mono the center channel by itself and you really heard how bad the vocals sound without all the support of all the rest of the music. And to me, 5-1 as a music format just really didn't do it for me because you've got two ears and I've heard some really great stereo recordings. And it's just, you know, as a convenience factor, I mean, who's going to sit there and install a 5-1 system in the garage so that they can, you know, work on their car?
I don't think they will, but if they have a home theater already set up or they have a 5-1 system in their car, you know, some high-end cars come with it.
I have that myself at home. I have, you know, like six speakers linked up, you know, to my hi-fi and to the but it's really for movies that I enjoy. It's because you
see, music.
Yeah, it's like you feel like you're watching a movie, you're watching a live thing, and you feel like all the explosions in the cars moving behind you is fine. But I still think when you think about music, you still think that you're at the gig and you're seeing the band in front of you, and there's usually a speaker on the left, a speaker on the right. You tend to want the musicians to be in a certain place together to be unified. So, you know, it is fun to play with it and buy these special CDs for your special albums, but I don't really look for that as much as I look for it for movies.
So I actually like 4.1. I mean, no jokes aside. But you know what I find kind of amusing is that, you know, when 5.1 started in theater, you had a 30 to 50-foot screen. And what happens is Phantom Center just goes away. So no matter where you're sitting, you can't hear it. Not only that, if you're on the left or right side of the theater, you're not going to get the full
effect.
And the dialogue's going to be weird. So what they said is we're going to have a center channel, and the whole film's going to be based there. So no matter where you sit, you're always going to get that center channel. Well, then they sit there, and you go into your living room, which is, you know, got a six-foot spread, and all of a sudden you got that center speaker. You don't need it. So what happens is you've got the center channel. Why? Because theater's got it. And I just don't think you need it. Meanwhile, I think there's a lot of credibility for having a left-right surround left-right and a dedicated sub to kick it a little bit. I think that's a cool format.
It's funny you should say that because, you know, now they're trying to push 7-1. I mean, what's your thoughts on the 7-1? It's like, my gosh, how many more speakers are you going to be trying to throw in your living room?
I think Lexicon should go back to reverbs.
Well, that closes that topic.
Interesting thing there with 5-1 systems that the acoustics of the room come into play so much more than the stereo. I mean, than the two speakers,
yeah.
Because there's so much more chance of screwing up. You know, you can put, you know, you go into people's houses and they get the center channel pretty okay, and they got the left and right okay on different bookshelves, but they got the surrounds, like one's on top of this, and it's like, and it's really hard to get a full effect of. And forget about the 110 degrees off-center axis for focus.
And the acoustics of a room, I mean.
Big time.
I mean, all rooms are boxes.
Well, yeah, that's true. And not only that, but come on, how many people have we, you know, you go into the living room and you hear their subwoofer and it's just so overpowering, you know, all their little speakers.
But also the thing is, most people stick a couch against the wall, the back wall. Where's your surrounds? Above you. On the back wall. So the question is, how does that even work? You could put it on the side, but the couch is usually a little bit to the left of the room or the right of the room. It's not always perfectly center. I mean, and what happens is I think that the, you know, husband brings it back, goes, I want 5-1. And the wife goes, how's this going to get set up? I don't know.
Well, that's why I said the wireless thing is going to be a major thing, because sometimes you need a surround speaker to be someplace that there's no way you could ever run wire to it.
It's true.
You know where I also think the 5-1's really going to help, and this is kind of a sideways thing? Gaming.
Yep.
Everybody's brought up with video games.
No, that's true.
Then these are the people that computers are normal, video games are normal, iPods. It's the same group of people, but they're going to want to hear everything the way they're used to hearing it. And I think that video games is going to – in some ways, lead people down areas that.
Excellent format, too.
Yeah.
For it. Perfect.
Okay, Larry, your system? Do you listen to 5.1 audio music, or are you stereo most of the time? Because you've got, like, the best stereo of anybody I ever know.
Well, there's requirements for specific reasons sometimes for that sort of thing. But I listen to some audio in stereo and some in surround, depending on the material, it seems. I like to listen to live things that put me in sort of the audience field. I've experimented with listening to standard stereo things in 5.1. Sometimes has a good effect, but things that are recorded and mastered in stereo, I listen in stereo.
I do have to say, the first time I ever heard any music in Larry's home theater, it altered my life.
I have to have a good reference in order to make good equipment,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that is so true. I can tell you, when you can practically see the color of the reverb, yeah. It's like you know you're listening to a really good stereo system. And, it was truly a life-changing experience for me, too. One thing I want to ask the songwriters here, Martin, do you ever – when you write, do you hear in stereo, or do you ever hear in a surround format? Could you ever picture yourself when you're writing, you know, envisioning a tune?
That's an interesting question, because all the years I've written, I've never really thought of it as anything being separated, because you really, when you start writing, you're down to usually your voice, a melody, and an instrument, and that could be a guitar or a piano. Only when I get to recording the track, and with today's technology, you tend to think, well, I could put that here, I could put that there. But when I first start writing, you're thinking of, for me personally, it's not so much about production in any way. It's all about the melody, the atmosphere, and what you're trying to say. You know, and you sing through your voice. So, you know, your voice isn't going to be separated. You know, you'd have to go to hospital to have that done. That would be a terrible operation. I know a few people have done that. But I see the production value later on, you know, that when I'm – and most songwriters now have their own studios, and, you know, we have great luxury in panning and having, you know, wonderful systems. So it comes down to that, really, at the end. And I never thought about 5.1. I'm still thinking about – I'm sat in front of two speakers. I've got two ears. And how am I going to make the communication of the song come across? It's great fun, and it's to pan and to have, you know, some instruments very wide. But again, it's quite interesting if you look back at the Beatles and some of the greatest records they made, right through the 60s and 70s, they only did mono mixes, and stereo mixes were done for glamour and just for the enthusiasts. Like we're talking about 5.1, stereo was that, and it was all the stereo mixes were thrown away. Done in an hour, while the mono mixers, which they believed were the best way to record music, that's what they spent all their time on. And to this day, still some of George Martin and some of the engineers prefer the mono mixers because they created it that way, and they still think they had the punch and the power and the integrity of the recording of the band being unified together. There was something magic about that. But, you know, answering your question, I don't think at all in stereo or anything else when I'm writing. When you first start, you're just thinking about, you know, the first communication, which is your voice and a single instrument.
No, but Martin, don't you think that if the Beatles, for example, had the ability to have access to the technology we have today, wouldn't they have been creative maybe in surround?
I think the White Album would be out yet.
I think that's a great question, actually. And in a lot of ways, George Martin talks about that, because after Sgt. Pepper, which everybody thinks is, you know, one of the most special albums of all time, he said he didn't think the new technology would have benefited the music. He thought that because they only had four tracks, because they had to work in a certain way, that the music reflected that. But I do think if you gave, you know, if they had that experimentation back then, the music would have sounded very different, and they would have utilized it. But, you know, the producer himself said that the four tracks made us work harder. Because, you know, when you have all this luxury and you don't necessarily work harder, you tend to have so many options that it makes it harder for you to make the right choices. You know, you think, I can have 19 versions of this, or let's keep going. So I think in a way, we, particularly for me as a songwriter, with all the new technology, I have to say to myself, think small. And think, you know, communicating a message powerfully and not get fly off at all the options you have, you know.
I agree with everything Martin was saying, and it's amazing how simple concepts like melody and the things that actually matter in music get diluted by all the toys and bells and whistles.
Melody? I remember that.
It's the bit you sing. It's the bit you sing. But, you know, I agree the old mono mixes that were done back then are just perfect and there's nothing you change about them. But it's also a lot of fun to hear what they did with stereo because there were no rules about stereo back then, so it was okay to just let's put the drums on the left side and all the vocals on the right. Or let's
put. They didn't have pan pots then, though. They had switches.
Yeah, it was switches.
Left, right, or that's it.
Or they'd have to solder. You know, let's put the get the soldering iron. We're going to put the strings to the left.
Left, right, center. Yeah.
But I will also say this. There are now people who do write with 5-1 in mind, and I'm just – the first guys I ever met who did this kind of thing, it's a group called Studio Voodoo, and they're friends of mine now. And they were the first group I had ever heard that did an album that they wrote the songs, they conceived them in surround from the beginning, and – I will have to say that was a life-altering experience the first time I heard that stuff, too. I was at a surround show.
Your life has been altered.
And many times, and always by sound, which is very strange. But hearing that stuff, to hear music that was not remixed in surround but was conceived in surround, that stuff, you know, they have a stereo version of it you can hear, too, and it's fine. But the surround version really is an amazing experience. And the stereo version is cool music, too, but – it's not as unique an experience.
Yeah, I think what's great about music is that it brings different things to different people and it serves many different purposes. I just, a couple of days ago, heard a quad version of Dark Side of the Moon, and wow, that was a lot of fun. Just hearing the choices that were made, what was in the surrounds, where the guitar was going. Some of it was a little schmaltzy, but it was just really interesting to see the choices that were made. And I also think that kind of music played very well to a 4.1 kind of mix.
It's amazing, though, mixing for stereo, just, you know, that's kind of a challenge, too. I've found that lots of times mixing, doing a standard old stereo mix, you'd be, lots of times when I'm battling with the mix and it's not kind of working, I go, hang on, what's going on here? And 9 times out of 10, I'll be monoing things and bringing things in because you end up separating the hell out of things and everything becomes all disjointed. And then the nice source that the band or whoever's doing this performance just doesn't crack it. And you're like, you know, I mean, perfect example, most samples, dare I say, of basses these days, which I personally dislike, they're all stereo, terrible. And you stick them up and like, nothing's centered. And then you've got stereo kick drum and everything's like nothing's kicking you in the ass. So, you know, I really think that it's valuable mastering a two-track.
So many people don't realize or never had the experience of having to make their stuff mono-compatible for or vinyl-compatible.
Vinyl-compatible. Remember the old 150 shelf? He's like, okay, we can't put the bass on. I remember a mate of mine actually mixed a bass guitar through a Dimension deal. You guys remember the old Dim Dogs?
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful. And he cut it, and he's like, yeah, check this out. And he went down to the master room, and they're like, the needle kept popping. They were cutting down the lathe, and it's like, dude, they just monitored the bottom end. You know?
It's a great bass track. We'll just have to make that the second cut on the album. We'll put everything except the bass first, and then they can listen to the bass separately.
Yeah. You know, Kestrel, though, sounds amazing in 5.1.
Oh, sure. Definitely.
I mean, you're just like, boom, you're in that room, and it's just mind-altering.
Larry had a good point. A live recording of a band is actually nice, because I'm sure you feel like the crowding here, somebody – tugging on a joint next to you.
You know what? If a classic album is going to be remixed in surround, I mean, I've heard some that were done great and some that I think are terrible. If you have the original artist involved in the process, so it's still their vision, even if it's 20 or 30 years later, usually that leads to a good product.
Didn't you work on the Woodstock? Did you work on the?
Yeah, we remixed. My partner Gary O and I remixed Woodstock from the original masters, but that was not. I'm trying to think if we did any of that in surround. No, that was all stereo.
I was
in the session where they were remixing Bohemian Rhapsody in surround, and Brian May was there making the creative calls. And I have to say that's one of the coolest moments. I could say it was life altering, except I actually wasn't there that long. But it was a nice evening.
Hey, listen. Speaking of Bohemian Rhapsody and the 5.1, Larry. You want to tell them about where we heard?
We heard an example of that as well. Mike and I were in Nashville and were at Blackbird Studios, which is owned by John McBride, and there's a George Massenburg room in the complex. And we were privy to Bohemian Rhapsody in George Massenburg's control room, which was I think it was life altering there as well.
I bet it was. It was a 5.1 version. It was powerful to say the least.
Sure.
It was, especially in that environment. I don't know if you've seen pictures of his room, but it's all diffusion. It's phenomenal.
Wood things were sticking. Is that the one?
Yeah. And it sounds.
Thousands of them.
Just amazing. With different lengths. It's perfect diffusion.
And it almost sounds like you're outdoors, indoors. I mean, the sound just like goes and you just don't see it. It's not coming back. It's just leaving.
But it's not dead.
No, but it's not dead.
You speak in the room. It's not really dead. It's diffuse. It's roomy somehow.
Well, you guys obviously did live. You remember what it was like being in the biggest room in the world. Generally, you did outside gigs instead of sheds. It was great. And you'd be on tour, and your next night is in like a 10,000 seat. It's like, oh, shit. Metal and everything.
What's the name of that hall that's in Washington? Is it Constitution Hall?
It is, in fact.
That's like playing in a giant bathroom. I mean, it's just.
Oh, yeah. The reverb tail from the last time we played there is still ringing. It's like 14 years ago.
Talking of which, you guys ever been seeing a show down at the Staples Center here? It sucks. I went to see Prince. He's one of my favorite artists. You know, I dig him big time. I was quite close, and it sounded like it wasn't the engineer's fault, poor guy, but the room just sounds terrible.
This part of the podcast sponsored by the Staples Center.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I will say, Bobby, I was fortunate to hear the sound check for
Streisand.
Barbara Streisand.
I remember when you went there.
And they did treatment
in the
place for several days prior to the performance and made a vast improvement in the room.
It's a shame that again, it's like the Beta VHS story. They've just adopted that as a live venue. It's like, guys, can't you just...
It looks good. Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, which brings us back to the 5.1 and the fact that people like to listen to it, especially for live performances, because half the performance is the hall that you're listening to it in. You know, hearing a show, you know, in it's now called the Apollo, but the old, you know, Hammersmith Odeon over in London is different than hearing the same show done over at, you know, the Garden in New York. So, you can definitely see that 5.1 for live performances is a winner.
It's submersive. I mean, you want to be in that environment.
Yeah, of course.
Wherever that is.
That's true.
And as long as you have the 5.1 audio, you might as well, you know, throw video up on the screen too. So that's why I guess concert videos are so popular. All right, well, hey, we're going to take a break right
now. HD or not HD? Or actually Blu-ray?
Yeah, Blu-ray.
Or HDTV.
Why is blue everything? Why don't they ever come up with another color, like, you know?
Purple ray.
And a Bluetooth, now Blu-ray. Why don't they come up with another color?
All right, well, we're going to ponder that and take a break. And when we come back, we'll have the answer.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and we're here with Larry Dropa, president of API. And right now, we're going to talk a little analog audio. Larry, why don't you fill us in on some of the stuff that's happening over at API?
Well, we have a couple things happening that are new that I can't actually reveal to you at the moment, but we're working on a couple new products. The problem, if you will, with API is that we can't stray very far from the history of the company. We manufacture Mike Preez EQs, compressors that have been made for many years now, and we stick to that design philosophy. So new products generally tend to be revisions of tried and true designs.
Well, that's because most people are familiar with the API sound here. How many of you guys have used API gear around here?
All of us, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the way around the table. That's good.
All the way around the table.
That's good. Okay, it's an API-friendly room here. Tell us just a little bit about the history of API and how you got involved, because...
What it stands for. API, the proper name of the company is Automated Processes Incorporated, which was the original name of the company, started in 1968 by Saul Walker, and Lou Lindauer originally founded the company. And strangely enough, they started the company as a company to provide some products for the theater industry, and moved on to making some of the first multi-bus capable consoles to answer the demand for a console that can either record or mix multi-track audio.
Just so I can have full disclosure here, I'm the president of Westwave Audio, amongst other things that I do, and we're the new LA API dealers.
Yay! Yay!
So,
but yeah, no, but and the reason why I want to bring that up is because I actually started my API journey by working with Larry on a documentary of the company, and we've traveled around to Nashville, New York, and went back to Baltimore, and interviewed a lot of engineers, and the one thing that I noticed to all the engineers and the producers that I interviewed is there was just this amazing passion for API gear. I mean, people just were really passionate about it. Like, I won't mix without it. And I started becoming a fan. And then when I heard it and got to spend some time with some of the API gear, it's like, I really have to bring this out to LA, and we really have to set up a place where people can come listen to it, because you can have a plugin, and you can have, you know, all the digital Pro Tools and everything, but when it comes down to just manipulating sound with getting a good input, a good mic pre, a good EQ, you just cannot beat the analog gear. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, you can't beat API. You got to love that sound. It's an aggressive sound. It's an open sound. And one thing that that I noticed about API is, you know, there's been some transitions with the company, and Larry, why don't you talk a little bit about how you've been able to maintain such a high quality of API? Because when people say API, you just think – you think the best.
Yes. Well, I think we have to credit the original founders of the company, who had a military background, and some of the early products they designed had military spec parts, and so very high quality and very long-lasting devices, which is why even in 2006, all API products carry – a 5-year unlimited warranty. And one of our comments is that if you buy another piece of audio gear after 2 or 3 years, it may be obsolete and you still have a couple years left on your API warranty.
Why don't you tell people about your background with the ATI Group and the Paragon Board?
Okay, well, we originally started ATI in 1988 to manufacture live sound products. And we manufactured the ATI Paragon console, which was used in live sound for many years, and then had the opportunity in 1999 to acquire API. There was really no intention to cause customer confusion between ATI and API. It just required us that we pronounce our letters very distinctly. But we acquired API, and the combination of two companies made a lot of sense, because ATI was very quality conscious. Customers are fiercely loyal to the brand, as they are with API. When we had the opportunity to acquire API, the perception and deliverables, if you will, of API had suffered a little bit. And so we had our work cut out for us to sort of re-energize the brand and bring some products back that hadn't been well represented. And so we've worked for the last several years to really make API the strong company again that it was at one time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was basically a perfect marriage between two companies, because ATI had such high standard and API has such great quality. So, you know, just when I visited your factory and I've seen your engineers and your tech support just doing a great job replacing, customer sends a 560 in for some service to replace the little rubber nibs and all the little bands of EQ, I think that's just, without asking, that's just great.
Do you mean
service.
API equipment does have to get returned sometimes?
We do see some pieces back every now and then. You've been underwater or something.
But not that we're going to turn this into a giant commercial for API, but why not? Bobby, why don't you – you told me a really great story about the first time you ever heard some API gear.
Oh, first time – well, it was in South Africa about 150 years ago when I was about 60 years old. Mm-hmm. No, I was cutting a band and we had a choir in there. It was a nice African choir. They had great voices. And we had a couple of mics up I can't remember what they were now, but either way, and we had a couple of mic pre's on the things, and they sounded a little near pale. And there was a couple of API mic pre's, and I plugged them in, and I went straight to tape as I always did, and it just came alive. And it was like, man, it's a big difference. It's a big difference. And it was just a couple of old APIs, and said, well, we haven't used those old things for a long time. And they switched on, and they were there. And they do sound great. And I mean, we're not here to stroke you, but be honest, obviously it's no secret. It's great sounding. Great
well,
sounding
you know,
batteries.
It is surprising.
And simple, real simple. And as I loved about it.
It's surprising to us sometimes to see some of the really, really old gear that comes back, on knob breaks or switches eventually wear out. And we see some of that stuff come back that's been around for a long, long time. And people will, send it in with a little note, say, you please fix my old 550 and hurry up because it's hard to do without this for very long. So it's gratifying to see those kind of things. And it's also nice to, every now and then to get an email from someone a new customer who's heard about the history of the company and pined for a piece of API gear for many years and eventually makes the decision to buy. And, oftentimes you hear complaints a lot more often than you hear compliments. But when you get a compliment from someone, I had one recently, a guy who sent an email in that said, I've wanted a piece of API gear for a long time, but I finally made the decision. I sold a couple of pieces of something else that he had. He bought a 512 mic preamp. He says, I brought it in and plugged it in. He said, I had a drummer play. And I went in the other room, and he said, I nearly cried. Yeah. He said, my drums have never, ever sounded so good. Yeah. He says, money well spent, and it's the best decision he ever made.
Definitely. Too poor to buy cheap, that's the saying. And it's really good. Best to put your money in a good spot.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of the few things where you buy a piece of quality analog gear, it's going to be with you for 10 years, 20 years. I mean, it's just going to last.
And more than likely, it's going to get more valuable, too, unlike a plug-in.
The thing. I was talking with Larry over lunch today, and we were talking about, you get a lot of guys that are comparing the old API gear with the new API gear, and they're doing phase testing and trying to see if the cues are the same on the 560s and things like that. And what people don't understand is that whole element of time has to be factored in to how the sound sounds, because the years when you bake a piece of equipment for 10, 15 years,
caps dry out.
Exactly. And you got that little age thing that kind of adds to.
Larry said something interesting that I really like about the company is that they make the same stuff as they did 20 years ago. It's great because many great companies, and there, of course there are other great audio companies, that they'll make something and it's like, then version 2 comes out and you're like, why is this quite, don't sound too good? And then all of a sudden, they've put an extra VCA on the output, or they've just changed it. So it's just like a digital switcher. It's nothing much, no digital really, or something. And there's always some minor change. Evidently, it seems that you guys have just stuck to your old patterns. Like, well, this works, ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, I think that was a criteria that we inherited. When we bought the company, we all sat down and said, there are some things that can't change. The heart of API gear is the op amp, transformer. So the same op amp, same transformer, the API knobs. We can't go to plastic knobs. It just wouldn't be allowed. So there are some things like that can't change, even though we try to come up with new products or different applications of the same idea. There's the heart and soul of the company can't change.
I like the feed forward and feedback option on the 2500. That's a nice option. That's a modern.
That's a modern touch.
I like that.
Well, that compressor is just such a great compressor because you can be as dainty as you want, but then you can just slam it and just be as aggressive as you want. It's funny. One thing about API is I put together Martin's Pro Tool Studio, and the first thing that we kept when we put it together was the lunchbox. He has a lunchbox, and you use that every day, don't you?
Yeah, I do. It's just, for me, because I'm now in the digital world, and I came through the analog world, it's a matter of balance, keeping the live room still in touch with the new technology. I love working on digital because of the speed. And as Bobby brought up earlier, you're not dealing with a tape machine that you have to keep lining up. And all these things are wonderful luxuries. But when you do still keep that organic sound, it's a wonderful balance. And then really, again, what Bobby's pointed out to me, and I think yourself, is that your Pro Tools becomes a very strong tape machine, yet you're still bringing those acoustic instruments in, particularly the voice. API is beautiful for that. You know, I fell in love with my lunchbox because I would be moving at two different studios right back in the 80s. And it's interesting, really. You're right. We put the new studio in, and then we instantly dragged this little lunchbox in and put it by on the floor, left side of my leg, so that I could put my bass through it and put my acoustic guitar through it. And I've never known really a preamp that has quite that clarity and quite that punch, and just feels very real to me. Everything that you deal with today always has a little bit of color to it, but the API, although it has its own color, makes you feel like you're hearing the throat clearly, you're hearing the strings clearly, and it's got a great attack to it, you know. So it's something that I wouldn't want to do without in my studio. And in fact, funny enough, because I'm a songwriter, when I read reviews of other producers and other writers, they're also talking in the same language. And recently I read about Daniel Lemoine and his studio, and it was, again, API came up as, you know, one thing that he has to carry with him at all times.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, Larry, you made some really good products, and you're still making some great products.
Well, thank you. And I would add, I think, Martin, that I hope we recognize that technology is changing as well.
Right.
And we recognize we're not in all analog world, mm-hmm. But hopefully analog stuff needs to be somewhere in that chain still.
I think it's particularly now. It's really quite hip to have your analog equipment still there. I think I brought up in the last podcast that, you know, when I built my digital studio, I was going, okay, the studio's going to have to go. This is going to have to go, and I can dump that because I don't need it anymore. And now, after working there for a year and writing, I've fallen in love with having that balance. You know, it's a real 50-50 thing for me. And, you know, some of the greatest recordings that we all love from the past still have that great character of analog recording. And frankly, to me, it's exciting to have some API or some, you know, some old Vox amplifiers there, because that's got so much character. I mean, and I'm talking about character the same way we would listen to a person's voice. We say, that's a great singer. You know, we don't want to change that because that's the way he is. That's his tone. That's his sound. And some of the equipment built at that time was extraordinary and made great records, you know, and made great character records. And I'm determined to keep that still in the chain.
Any, is there any possibilities of making it portable, battery operated? Speaking as the sound effects guy here, because where I go, there's not always AC.
Car battery, you're done.
Can you strap a car battery around your waist, maybe?
Been there, done it. A little heavy.
We could have just run out of 9 volts and just down at the headroom.
Yeah.
Sound like a Mackie. Oh, yeah. The best Mackie. Yeah.
Extension cord. That's the key.
I guess that's an answer no.
Well, maybe I'll say we'll think about it. How about that? I'll go to engineering with that question.
Actually, studios, I know in England there was a stage, and I'm probably here too, where they used to run their console on DC batteries because it sounded quieter and cleaner.
Yeah.
And keep
well,
it
there's
clean.
No cleaner.
The DC, that's it. A
supply,
battery. That's
right.
It. Absolutely. And you get all the RF, all the hum and AC coupling out of the room. It's amazing. So you'd have a good recording.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I go into studios and I sort of look to see if there's a piece of Neve there or there's an API, you know, because it makes you go like, oh, okay, these people are quite serious about what they're doing. You know, there's a heritage here, and that's important.
One thing I noticed when I was doing the documentary, which, by the way, the documentary will be premiered at Summer NAMM, so it will be done. But it seemed like a lot of the American engineers were going for the British sound, and a lot of the British engineers were going for the American sound, you know?
The grass is always greener.
Exactly. It's exotic.
But, you know, that really brings up a good point with analog audio. It's you know, a lot of people are writing analog audio out, but, you know, there's this little
bring it on
renaissance of the analog way. And I got a couple of questions just to put on the table. The first question I got for you guys is, what part of the recording process in the analog way, where you had the console and the tape machine, is there a part of that process that you miss now that you're working with a digital world, with your Pro Tools, with the Cubase, with with whatever your DAW choice
is. I'm still analog, so.
Well, I know you.
Yeah, so, I mean, I just record. I use I use Nuendo, but I use that for purely a MIDI recorder and a digital audio recorder. But the rest I use analog in and analog.
But you're not using an analog tape machine,
are you? No, not a tape machine anymore. No, well, that's what I'm saying. It just replaces the tape machine.
Well, I'll tell you. I'm going to start this because one thing I miss about not having tape is. Tape is, you know, if you record something on a 24-track on a 2-inch and then you accidentally, you know, punch into it or you erase just a little bit, you still have the whole other part left. And with Pro Tools, it's just so unforgiving. I mean, you get a hard drive crash and boom, your song is gone, you know. And
well, or so 100 of your songs.
Exactly. So I don't, you know, you could say the same thing with tape in that, you know, well, if you lose the tape or you damage it, but there, it was something, it was physical and it wasn't this, just this virtual thing out there in the world. And I kind of miss that kind of, that permanence that you had with tape.
You never lost a sync track though on a tape machine, did you? Analog tape machine? No. So then you did.
There's no doubt that I've only just really recently changed over, and I know that when I listen to the analog tapes, there's something about music hitting the tape. I still feel that if we were to listen to a well-recorded 24-track on a Studer with a Dolby SR, and then we go to Pro Tools, I still think I would lean towards the tape. The only reason I've moved it to Pro Tools is because I have to, because everybody's dealing with that, and also I get the luxury of many more tracks and a great speed, which is beautiful, and I wouldn't want to lose that either. But tonally, I still think I would go back and still want – I still would like the sound of a Studio SR better than I would with digital recording.
But that comes down to the analog gear. I mean, I think what's interesting is that there's a new industry – or not a new, I think it's the old industry that's found a new niche, and that is trying to create character. I mean, I think that a lot of the workstations, whether it's Pro Tools, Nuendo, or any of the workstations out there, they kind of capture it, but they don't capture the color. And the color that we're trying to get is from a lot of the analog gear that we own, whether it be the microphones we use or any types of processors that go between the microphone and the recorder. I think that that's kind of the signature of the sound. And then I think the convenience of storage, of instantly recalling things and having that at an instant access and lots of tracks and having, you know, a drive that weighs, you know, 2 ounces rather than, you know, pounds of stuff. I think that's the convenience. But I think going back to, you know, shit in, shit out, I think that when you get great sounding pieces of gear, it's just nothing can beat it.
I mean, if I could choose, and they said to me, you've got the same capabilities as Pro Tools, but it's going to be, but it's your Studer.
Right.
I would go for the Studer.
Well, you, the ultimate best way for me, I think, is recording is to actually have a 16-track head stack on a 2-inch tape and run it at a certain speed, whatever speed you like, and then dump it straight to your a decent digital recording
system.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. That's still the ultimate way to do it.
But I also have a question, which is maybe different. What sample rates are you guys recording at?
It depends. Mostly.
192, 96, 48.
48 to me. Mostly.
Yeah, usually 48 still.
See, now what's interesting is I've started all my recordings at 96. And sometimes then I'll convert it to 48. And the difference between 96, even converting to 48, is the same difference between normal TV and HD TV.
Really?
It's significantly different. I'm starting to hear gear differently.
Wow.
And a while back I ended up actually doing something kind of crazy. I did a movie called Kill Bill, and I got a scoring stage and hired 9 karate guys, and we broke things and destroyed things and hit each other. And what I did was I actually did, because we did used a lot of metal. We had to do a ringing of a sword, which was a character sound in there. And I did 2 Pro Tools systems, one at 192 and one at 48. And what I found that, not this is a Pro Tools ad, but what I found at 192 is what I heard back is what I heard in. And I thought that was very interesting. 48, what I put in, what I get out is totally different. But all of a sudden it became much more transparent, and that was important to me because now when I did that, I actually recorded with about 24 different microphones because I wasn't sure what I was going to get. So then I could actually start hearing all the characters of the microphones and the different qualities. And I think that's really important because as we capture some of this amazing outboard gear, that the best way you're going to capture the analog sound is with a really high-quality digital format.
Oh, interesting, yeah. Now, let me ask you a question. Was your Pro Tools rig, was it locked with like a big band, or were you just running off the internal clock? Because I found
what front end were you using?
I found the especially on Pro Tools, boy, when the whole clocking issue.
You need a good clock. It's imperative that you get a stable clock. That's very very important.
Because 48 without a clock and 48 with a clock is a huge difference. I mean, it's the difference between hearing the stick hit the hi-hat with a clock, or if you don't have the clock, then you hear the stick, you know, kind of hit this metal thing. It's just not focused, you know, and so.
There's a blur there.
Yeah.
I heard it a lot in reverb. I mean.
Oh, yeah.
All of a sudden, or any kind of ambience you record, all of a sudden you hear. For me, in the film type stuff, I want to hear 20 feet behind the screen. And that's important. It's easy to get the surrounds here, the 20 feet out off the screen, but I want to hear that depth of field. And a lot of times, you know, a clock and high recordings and that was actually what made me experiment with high sampling rates, is I was actually trying to re-record reverb, and sometimes that's all you would hear, and I could never get it to sound right. And it was very frustrating. Then I went to high sample rates, and I'm starting to get the imaging back.
I don't think a lot of people realize, if you ever want to test your A to D converters and test, you know, the real tweaky parts of your system, recording a reverb is just the widow maker of tests. Some gear that you might have a hard time telling the difference between with other kinds of signals, reverb tells. I learned that from Scott.
Yeah, that and metal. Like rain. Right. I mean, actually, the hardest thing we've actually recorded is
the
rain.
Overtones.
The overtones and weird harmonics, things that don't have a fundamental. Incredibly
difficult to record digitally. So wait, so if you want to check out an EQ, like an analog EQ or something, do you run a reverb through it and you can hear, you know, what?
No, I think they're talking about.
No, we're talking about more the conversion process, okay, like getting into the digital world,
resolution
or processing once you're in the digital world.
But it's different because a lot of times I've got lots of different location recording devices, and I actually did a test when I was actually in Herbie. I was recording cars, and I had some recorders, the exact same mic setups at 48 and some at 96. 96 sounded great, but then I release formats 48. So I found that by downsampling, it sounded way better from 96 downsampling to 48 than 48 straight. Don't know why.
It's kind of like Photoshop. If you do a picture in Photoshop with like 200 dpi or 500, 600 dpi, and you dither it down to 72, it looks good. But if you did it in 72 all the way down and just left it at 72, it would still look grainy. Yeah.
So basically, as the resolution gets better, analog gear becomes even more important.
Absolutely.
Your front end becomes even more important because it's getting more and more transparent. And you think we'll ever reach a point where, we could be there with sample rates of 182, we're actually more transparent than, you know, analog tape ever was, where it's just going to be. I mean,
analog tape's not transparent.
Right. No,
it's very pleasing.
Yeah, it's just
transparent. But, you know, were you going to go after 192? I mean, what's that going to sound like?
Well, DSD is what that sounds like. Yeah, I don't know if DSD is ever going to take off in any, you know, global way. But
well, that's true. You're right with the DSD. And
when you hear DSD for the first time, and it's been out for years now, but when you hear it for the first time, you realize, oh, we're hearing something different. This is a step
above. But, you know, it goes back to, in some ways, how we started this conversation with Blu-ray and HDVD, in that before, well, there was just never the memory to be able to put it on a CD. So why even think about it? Now, all of a sudden, memory in our lifetime now is no longer becoming a problem. I mean,
I can't remember things.
It's just not. So in that way, it doesn't become a limiting factor.
Hey, do you guys have any particular, and this doesn't have to be an API love fest, so I just want to let you know, any particular piece of analog gear that you just not part with ever? Because I know, well, Martin.
1073s.
Well, I know you're fond of your Dimension D.
Yeah, my Dimension D I'm in love with, I must admit. It was given to me by George Massenburg when when I was working with him with Earth, Wind & Fire, and he just gave it to me because he said, this is a gift from Roland, and I've just picked it up from Japan or something. And I must admit, I plugged it in at first, and I couldn't hear it doing anything to anything. I kept hitting all the knobs and going, it's not working, you know. And then I started to study it a little bit better, and I started to push every knob in I could, and all of a sudden I could just hear this wonderful, very, very discreet chorusing, which was very useful to me for vocals and for guitars. A lot of the records that came out of that period, you know, like by The Fix, were using it on everything, on drums. And it has a really beautiful, discreet imaging and it brings things out of the track. So I love that. And it's funny enough, it's, I think they're trying to bring it out now in software because it's such a famous piece of work. I love that. And also, I do miss my Studer. You know, my, and I'm not going to get rid of the Studer because, as Bobby said, I think at a certain point you want to record those 24 tracks and then send them down.
Well, it just looks good too. Your Studer,
it certainly does. I've got an old Lindrum as well, which I just sort of put in a prime position so people walk in and say, Frankenstein.
Yes, it's a Lindrum.
You realize when George tells the story, he says that he lent you.
He threw it at me, like, take this away.
That's right. Yeah, I lent this to Martin, haven't seen it since.
And in fact, going to Bobby's studio, Bobby's whole studio is full of some beautiful stuff from, you know, back in the 80s and 70s, yeah. Which, you know, it's you don't really want to part with any of that because once you do, and I think now, as you were talking about, Mike, you get a feeling now it's very hip to utilize these keyboards and to play with them.
And they sound good, you know. I did an A/B test the other day of a plug-in. I won't mention the name of the company because it failed miserably.
Oh, but, come on, Bob!
It's this bass plug-in thing, anyway. But it's got this Moog patch. I'm like, oh, this is great, lovely. So I set it up, you know. I set it up. I put a 1K tone out the thing's cloak. Well, I pressed A and I calibrated it on my console. I did it the nerdy way. Got zero. I said, okay, let's play this thing. Played it. Doindy doindy. Oh, that sounds like a Moog. That's pretty good. I played my Moog. The thing just my sub bass went, hello, here we go. Everything started rattling in the speakers. You know, it's like, yeah, it's just not even. It, you know, I think the plug-in thing and the analog thing and the old crap as it is, mostly referred to lots of times, it's kind of like a video game. You watch a video game. If somebody says, hey, you want to try this video game? It's really great. You've got 5-1 speakers, you've got a steering wheel, it's a racing game. Here, and you sit there and you look down this thing, and for a couple of seconds every now and again, you think, well, I am in a car, but the G-force is not on you. You hear the cars whiz past, it's doing the old Doppler thing, and you think, oh, this is great. But you get into a real car, in this analogy anyway, you get in a real car and you smell the gasoline and the G-force pulls on you and your experience in life, that's analog and plug-ins.
It's exciting though now, isn't it? Because we're actually bringing the two worlds together because, you know, when the renaissance happened for digital, we sort of went, okay, it's gone, you know, and a lot of us sort of walked away from it. But it's quite magical.
Because we're coming to the end of like, we're like, man, how many versions of the sound can I do? I'm so fed up with hearing this kind of digitally regurgitated stuff. And believe me, I love digital. Don't get me wrong. I've got all the plugins, dig them, very great. But, you know, it's just so cool when you plug in your old analog stuff or your new analog stuff and you f*** around with it until you get some cranky sound. You say, let me digitize that.
Did you use the F word there?
Okay. I'd like to retract that.
He's very excited about it.
He used the PH
about.
Word. He says it with a PH, so it's okay.
Well, you know, speaking of the plugins versus the real thing, this afternoon I did a test for Larry with the 560 and the unauthorized 560 plugin. And there is just no comparison between the plugin and the real unit. The top end on a 560 is just so silky smooth. You can crank that, you know, 16K all the way up. You can just go all the way up and it's not going to sound harsh. You listen to the plugin and it just has that harsh little, I mean, you can practically see the stair step. What do you think about that, Larry?
Well, there's definitely a difference, yes. And, you know, me and plugins were opposite ends of the spectrum, as they say. Oh, so
that's why they put you and I sit in the same side of the table.
Yes, maybe so.
I can honestly say in my place, I probably have 25 or 30 pieces of gear that I also have the plugin version of, and there's not a single case where the plugin sounds the same or even
like
close to
doll.
As good.
It's really like a blow-up doll.
It's not even close, but
I've never used a blow-up doll.
You lent me the big one. Remember
okay.
That was the male one, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, different kind of plug-in, Bob. We'll talk about that later. But
there's going to be a lot of editing.
Yeah, a lot of editing. But the thing is, these plugins are incredibly convenient.
Yes.
And, you know, I might have an old analog synth that I have one of and it's one voice and I need 32 voices of it. So the plugin might be more convenient in that situation. But sound wise, I mean, I'm talking about instruments. I'm talking about all kinds of, compressors and limiters and gates and all these things. There's no plugin that's even close, but people don't realize it.
I'll be the detractor here because I love analog and there's nothing better than going through this amazing gear and the microphones also. But at the same point, I think that, you know,
API Chandler, all these great, wonderful, legend, how much access do people actually have? How much budget can they spend on the average person? And not only that, I need 32 of them to go across the tracks. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think the plugins play a role. And I think that it's a combination of both. I mean, I also have a lot of analog gear and a lot of plugins. And I think the combination of it is pretty amazing. Also, I'm curious to see, though, with the processor speeds becoming more available, whether eventually in the next generation and maybe our kids, whether we will be able to capture, because I think it's important in that, it's available now. It may not be available next year, but one thing that you said, Larry, that I thought was pretty cool is that keeping the integrity. Well, right now, the modeling of gear isn't up to the same standards mm-hmm. as analog is at this point. But once the resolution does get higher, there's something to be said to paying homage to the people that created amazing technology a while back that you may not even be able to get anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting that not this year, not next year, but maybe in 25 years where this stuff may not even exist anymore, or 50 years.
Basically, Larry, in 25 years, you're going to be selling soap.
No, but it's just
maybe
great.
I'll be selling plugins.
Yeah,
I understand what you're saying. It's like technology gets so advanced and fast, and look at the reverbs and things of that nature. The digital reverbs, nobody uses.
I'd like to ask Larry a question about those plugins. Did API never consider about having a plugin of their modeling?
Well, to this point, we haven't considered it because, again, we weren't convinced that you could accurately model a piece of gear with a transformer, for example. But it may be possible. We certainly change. We see regularly, the technology capabilities changing, and we may at some point be able to mm-hmm. accurately model those things to the point where they truly are a good representation. Mm-hmm. So can I say we'd never do it? No, we may.
Mm-hmm. I will say actually one thing, flipping now to the other side really quick, because I can have a lot of plugins. The problem is, Pro Tools 5, Pro Tools 6, Pro Tools 7, Wintel, mm-hmm. or MacTel. And all of a sudden, some manufacturers aren't there anymore. The question is, I don't think vintage plugins will exist. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, vintage gear will. And there's gear that I've had for over 10 years, and it does the exact same great job that it did mm-hmm. when I bought it. And I've had plugins that, a year and a half later, there's a new format change, and it's gone. You're not going to get it back.
That's a good point.
The other thing I'd say about plugins is that so much of marketing plugins has more to do with how they look than how they sound. Yes. And you can have people, you can model a certain piece of gear. If the plugin looks a lot like the piece of gear, there are plenty of people who will assume or believe that it sounds like that piece of gear because it looks like it. And it's just not true, but you could have the best sounding plugin in the world. If it's ugly, you're going to have a hard time selling it.
Well, look at all the generic audio engines that are out there where people are using the same audio engine, but just putting their own graphics on the front and putting their own little presets on there, but it's the same audio engine that they're using. Mm-hmm. Really quick, Rob, favorite piece of analog gear?
I've got to put in a plug. Because I don't know if anybody else at the table does, but I use a bunch of ATI gear from way before they acquired API.
Me too.
Yeah, that's right. The Pro 6 mic pre with the compressor and limiter and the gate. And it's a plug-in. You plug it into 120 volts and it works. And I love those things. Most of my favorite analog gear is musical instruments. I mean, I've got original Moogs and Prophet 5s and all that kind of stuff. And some new stuff, I'd have to say in the weird analog synth realm, there's a keyboard, or it's not a keyboard, a module called the Schwemann S1. It's spelled C-W-E-J-M-A-N. It's from Sweden. Weirdest synth in the world. But it's just great. It's totally old school modular patching synth with patch cords and everything. Very small. It's only 5 rack spaces. And it is just huge sounding. And thanks to Scott, you can hear it on, Chronicles of Riddick and probably some other things by now. But it's just an amazing sounding analog synth. And I still have a pretty big arsenal of analog synths. I'm more I'd say, into the synth gear than the I don't have as much vintage recording gear. I've got good front-end analog mic pre's and compressors and stuff, but the bulk of what I have is old instruments. And there's still, you know, there's still no way around it. A Juno 106 or a Super Jupiter, these are synths that there's still nothing better. And so I'd say I'm in love with that stuff.
I had a Juno 106, and I totally disagree with you.
Really? I can give you a list of specific records why I would disagree.
I know. Actually, it wasn't as bad as, what was it, the Memory Moog, where all those oscillators kept detuning?
Don't you be nasty to my Memory Moog. I got a beauty. Mine's lovely, but the fan is so loud on the thing. It's like,
here's one thing for plugins, tune. You know, tuning on a plug-in.
But there you go. That's where you're wrong, bro. I'm telling you something. The fatness of analog synths. When you hear a band playing together, three guitars, and they're slightly out of tune, and the guy hits the strings a little harder, that's when you get character. Otherwise, it's all bullshit. It's the same old picture again and again and again. Sorry.
Man, I just cannot say anything with Bobby there.
Yeah, you can.
You got to ask him about his favorite gear.
Yeah, Bobby, what's your favorite piece of gear?
I like my Mackie mixer. It's the best. It's the best 20 by 20 bandpass filter I've ever heard. Actually, I'm the. Shouldn't talk about Mackie like that. I like all the. I mean, you know, favorite God.
Desert Island. Desert Island has.
I believe Bobby's speechless.
Yeah. You know,
let's mark down this time.
I tell you, man, I couldn't say, it'd have to be a Neve mic pre, one of the 1073 for one. I mean, that's a beautiful mic pre. Some of the older compressors, you know, an API mic pre as well. I would say that. I'm not just saying it because you're here, I'll be honest. I love some of the SSL stuff. I love the SSL compressor, the old stereo bus compressor. I like LA2. I like 1176s. I like DBX-160s. I can't. It's like saying, what do you like? You know, just, what
who's
kind
your
of food do you
kid?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Scott?
You know, for me, it's mics and mic pre's. I have a pretty big collection of mics. And I do either for music or a lot of times for recording sound effects, whether they be Neumann, Sanken, Sheps, DPAs, as well as I do a lot of voice work. And I have ATIs, I got a Millennium. It's all about capturing the character of what goes in. And for me, choosing the right mic and the mic pre is my sound. And that's really important of what I'm going to get. And especially a lot of times what I do is I multi-mic record things for, like, this is going to be the high-frequency element of something and this is going to be a low-frequency element, and then I multi-track it so when I put it together, it actually comes in parts. So every mic and mic pre has their own little specialty for me, and that's really what I capture.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating. Larry, favorite piece of analog gear?
Well, you know, I'd have to stick with the company line here. But, you know, a 512 mic preamp has really been the heart of the company for a long time. And I've been hard-pressed in doing comparisons to hear anything that I prefer.
Well, I will tell you my absolute favorite piece of analog gear, and this is from somebody who's just recently found the analog world, is the 560. The 560 just convinced me to open up the API dealership, because if you can't make it sound good with a 560, it just doesn't sound good. You can put loops and guitars and your voice, anything. It's just such a silky smooth EQ. Well, we're going to wrap it up here on the Audio Now cast. And before we go, any parting words, guys? Anything you want to plug?
It's been a lot of fun, right?
It has been fun.
I've been in that red dress. So.
I would say thank you to everybody. I've enjoyed doing this, and thanks for your kindness. And
it's great to have you. Keep it up. Keep it vigilant.
And also throw this in there, thank you for keeping high quality in this day of age where everything's now packaged in plastic, and it's just, you know, it's made to, like, destroy and self-destruct in 2 days. Thanks for keeping the quality of yesteryear. Where the stuff will last 10 years. That's
right.
we'll continue to attempt to do that.
Yeah. Larry, do you want to tell people about the website and coming to visit your website?
Come and visit the website. It's apiaudio.com. Right now you can actually come and You can join a little contest to win a free piece of gear if you like.
Tell us the answer. Maybe we can enter.
Four.
Two.
All right. Well, this has been a great podcast. And until next time, this is Mike Rodriguez saying goodbye, along with Martin, Scott, Bobby, Rob, and Larry.
Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by West Wave Audio.